Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 248 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast. That's right, we are back. The off season is off, and it's now the on season. I'm Robin Warner, and today I am joined by the man some call the Brexit bread maker, Chris Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Robin. There is no Brexit. It was a lie, apparently.
Well, this is decidedly not Formula One, and yet it does seem Formula One adjacent because it's English. But I will tell you, you guys yet again are trying to out crazy us or something. But I still think America's got you beat right now. But you guys are definitely putting in an honest effort.
It is a bit of a mess, but this is an F1 podcast. And so we'll focus on that, shall we?
Glad you mentioned that. Today we are going to talk about the Australian Grand Prix, which was the first round of the Formula One Championship, and a few days ago now, I admit that. And, of course, I am going to spend a few minutes on IndyCar, and we're not done here, because Jamie Price will tell us a little bit about the 12 Hours of Sebring, as well as the World Endurance Championship race that happened there, because he was there shooting that. So some really interesting stuff going on there. Anyway, that is all to come after Formula One.
Should we cover some preseason news in case anyone was not paying attention?
Yeah, sure. For the cave dwellers among us, please.
So the highlights for me were that the introduction of an extra point for fastest lap was announced during the closed season.
Yes.
We had new aerodynamic rules that changed the front wings, much of which was discussed in too much depth during the testing.
Yes.
We have a new team called Alfa Romeo. Some may have heard of them. It won the championship back in the 50s. But it is just a Sauber in disguise.
They were dominant back in the 50s.
They were.
To think of them as, an also-ran of sorts is odd.
Well, they got points in their first race back, but we'll come to that later.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, well, let's get into the...
I think there's a couple of other highlights for me. One was we had a change of management at Ferrari. We had Ara Vibeni being booted for Binotto, which was quite significant. And then Patty Lowe is gone.
Oh, God, that's right. I'm glad you mentioned that. That was quite unceremonious. I mean, Williams didn't make the first test this season. It's just going from bad to worse. And then all of a sudden he's like, oh, he's leaving for personal reasons because of his family or something. I mean, that was just bizarre.
Well, I mean, they turned up late. They were like 3 days late. And then he couldn't explain why they were late. So as the main man who's responsible for delivering the car on time and, a high-level performance, that was probably not good enough. So I think they made an excuse and shoved him out the door, sadly.
I had such a fast and odd decline for someone that had risen so high.
Yeah, it was disappointing. I mean, I had high hopes for him returning to Williams and taking them back to some former glory, but it didn't work out at all well. So it's a shame. It's a shame.
Yeah, definitely so. Definitely so. And it is weird to talk about preseason stuff now that the first race is already over and we're only a couple days away from the second.
But you have to mention it because Ferrari won the winter season again. They've done it so many years now. They must be the all-time champs at winter season victories.
Well, I mean, they are yet still the all-time champs in the actual racing as well.
Oh, but, yes, you're right.
But they are narrowing that gap, and that is exactly what we're about to talk about here. So if you're ready, Chris, let's go over the results of the Australian Grand Prix. It was a Mercedes 1-2 yet again, this time with Valtteri Bottas in front of Lewis Hamilton. That is definitely going to be a point of discussion, I'm sure. It was the Honda-powered Red Bull racing car of Max Verstappen in third, rounding up podium.
Ferrari. Which engine, sorry?
Honda engine, sir. Trust me, I have plenty to say about that. Ferrari was fourth and fifth with Sebastian Vettel ahead of Charles Leclerc. However, He was ahead of him for reasons that we're going to talk about as well. Then it was Kevin Magnussen in sixth, and the leading Renault of Nico Hülkenberg in seventh. That Alfa Romeo car you mentioned earlier with its lead driver, the best car driver ever, Kimi Räikkönen, was in eighth, and Lance Stroll for Force India in ninth. 10th place went to Daniel Kvyat. Daniel Kvyat is back. He's in the Toro Rosso again, and he was 10th. Pierre Gasly was 11th. And where are we? Oh, Lando Norris in the McLaren was 12th. And I do believe, oy, that was the top McLaren. 13th was Sergio Perez. 14th, God, I don't know Albon's first name. What's Albon's first name?
Yes, I can't think of it. It's not Christian, is it?
I couldn't tell you. God, that's okay. So we're clearly
we'll have to look at that up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel actually a little bit better that we've gotten as far as 14th before I ran into this.
It's a lot of new drivers.
Yeah. 15th is Giovinazzi. Ah, God,
Giovinazzi. Yeah.
Giovinazzi. Thank you. And Mr. Russell in 16th for Williams, the lead Williams. 17th. Robert Kubica, and then we had three people that couldn't finish the race. That was Romain Grosjean, Daniel Ricciardo, and Carlos Sainz Jr. Okay, so, Chris, what do you think?
Well, as we were alluding to, is it Alexander Albon? There we go, Alex. Just checking. So Alexander Albon, double A, Ann Arbor. There you go. That's the way to remember that one.
Okay. Ann Arbor Albon. Ann Arbor Albon or Alexander Albon. Okay. Very good.
Yeah. So after, Ferrari's strong showing in the winter season, there was expectations that they would win in Australia, like they did last year, to be fair to them. And yet Mercedes locked out the front row by, 7/10 and then went on to dominate the race, scoring not just 43 points for a 1-2, but 44 because Bottas got the fastest lap as well. So, and they won by some margin. I mean, it was Vettel was some 50 seconds behind at the flag.
He was 57 seconds behind Bottas at the flag.
That's very true. So, very disappointing showing for Ferrari. And it doesn't sound like good news either because there's some reports suggesting that this could be an inherent issue with the vehicle design and their aero philosophy with the new front wing. But we'll come on to that later. But I think the stunning result was the return to form of Mr. Bottas because he had a tough old 2018, didn't win a race, should have won a couple, really. One he gifted to Hamilton, one he had a puncture on the last lap or penultimate lap. And he didn't have a lot of luck last year, and he came back like a man possessed and dominated. I mean, he's close to getting pole and then just disappeared right from the start, and Hamilton didn't know which way he went, although he was hampered a little bit with some damage to the car. But I still think he probably wouldn't have beaten Bottas even if his car had been perfect throughout the race. It looked like Bottas was the man on a mission.
Well, Hamilton had a damaged floor. Now, I don't know exactly how it was damaged. I don't know if it was debris or anything like that, but certainly that would have disturbed the aero a bit, and maybe he was suffering from a lack of downforce. But again, Bottas was totally switched on. And, it was fascinating because it really looked like Bottas had a really good shot at pole. But then right at the end, Hamilton clipped him. He had a 20.486 to Bottas's 20.598. So 10th of a second, but not a massive gap. But both of those were a healthy gap from third place Sebastian Vettel, 21.19. Fourth place Verstappen, 21.3. Fifth place Leclerc, 21.4. And then Grosjean was sixth with a 21.8. So, in just the top five, we had, a second of gap. And then there was another 0.4 after that. So all this talk about Ferrari being in front in testing and then just Mercedes really just put on an absolute clinic. They dominated.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, they were quick in Australia last year, and that, but Vettel was always within touching distance of Hamilton and was able to take advantage of the safety car. But they, you know, it didn't matter how many safety cars he had this weekend, that he was never, you know, even get on the podium. I mean, Verstappen didn't really have too much trouble, even with a Honda engine car passing him. So, you know, it looks troubling for Ferrari fans out there.
Yeah, but let's talk a bit about the second most powerful engine on the grid, the Honda.
Okay.
Max Verstappen on the podium for Red Bull Racing. And a damn fine showing on top of that. You know, he couldn't keep up with the Mercedes, but he was keeping Hamilton honest. Now, Hamilton said that he was pretty comfortable keeping Verstappen behind him, but it wasn't by that much. He probably had to turn the wick up more than he originally wanted to, did Hamilton. And Max Verstappen on the podium, and then right afterward he was interviewed, specifically praised the Honda engine. I want to point that out. And if we look at the results of the Toro Rosso's, also Honda-powered, were ahead of the McLarens, Renault-powered. So, what do you have to say to that, Mr. Roche?
Well, how many DNFs did they have? I think none, right? So one race down, four cars finished. Very good. So, you know, we'll go to the next race and we'll see how far they get. I think for sure, to give Honda credit, they are finally, you know, somewhat competitive. They still don't have party mode in qualifying, which is going to hamper them. But certainly they're there or thereabouts now. And with Red Bull's very good chassis, they're able to, you know, get fairly close. But I think, you know, they're still going to have reliability issues. I'd be shocked if they don't have reliability issues this season, which I think will hamper them throughout their, you know, championship campaign. So if, you know, Red Bull again proved to be very strong at certain tracks like Monte Carlo, for example, they're going to have to plan their engine replacement, and take the penalties that I'm sure will come. I mean, they don't have any at this stage, but their reliability was pretty bad last season. They've made a big step in performance, and to achieve good reliability and a performance step is tough. So I'm expecting them to struggle.
Yeah. Okay. So I am not surprised at all at your negativity, or we'll say cynicism, towards Honda. But you are aware that you did have to eat just a touch of humble pie, and I'm curious how that humble pie tastes. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to warm the oven as the Bahrain Grand Prix approaches.
Hey, look, you know, I still remember the glory years of 88, 89, well, and 86, 87, when Honda dominated the sport, right? And we were all excited when they decided to come back. And how many years are we back now in the turbo era with Honda? This is, what, their fifth season? And they still haven't produced the leading engine in F1. I mean, that's a fact, right? Now, they're getting more competitive, yeah. In another five or so years, they might be there.
All right. Listen, this is more to the point, though, is how much and how badly McLaren constantly blamed Honda for every last little problem. Now, I'm not saying they were entirely wrong, but I do think that McLaren was using Honda as a crutch. And I think that where we're seeing now after the Australian Grand Prix is some of that coming to fruition. The fact that McLaren is still in pretty bad sorts, and now they don't have a Fernando Alonso to kind of creep the results up. You know, obviously Carlos Sainz is good, but, you know, and Lando Norris showed real pace as well. But, you know, we're far cry from the McLaren we knew from, well, from the Lewis Hamilton days.
No, you're absolutely right. McLaren are were as much to blame as Honda during some of those epically awful seasons. I do think, you know, McLaren, like Honda, are seemingly getting better since the divorce. You know, Norris qualified eighth. He was faster than any of the Alfa Romeos or any of the STRs, right? So he was. So McLaren were the fourth best team in quali. They lined up behind that the two Haas drivers. He got a bit unlucky, Norris. I think in the race he got trapped behind Giovinazzi based on his longer first pit stop, and that kept him out of the points. But I don't think it was a disastrous first race for McLaren. And Norris did a good job. Carlos had some bad luck, didn't he? Had a DNF. So, I mean, you know, the Renault reliability is far from bulletproof either. We all know that. That's been their Achilles heel too. So, look, both individually now seem to be making some progress. But, yeah, I mean, certainly Honda finished higher in the race than McLaren. So, you know, good on them.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to leave it at that and not bewilder that, you know, not hold on to that point any longer. As long as you're conceding that I was, in fact, all along entirely correct.
So, I mean, I think we can't leave Red Bull without talking about Gasly, though, because that was a pretty poor first weekend in a Red Bull.
Oh, definitely so. It was disappointing to see. Qualified 17th, ended up finishing where? 11th.
11th, yeah.
Yeah, just, no, nothing great.
Yeah, he's struggling with the pressure, which we all know. You know, some teams will be a bit forgiving. Red Bull doesn't have a good track record on that one.
No, that's so true.
Yeah, if he doesn't pull his finger out, he'll be out of a seat pretty quickly, I think. But yeah, it looks like Verstappen's come to race. And I think, you know, if Honda continues to improve and they've got the reliability right, then he could be in the mix at the end of the season. No doubt about that. I think the gap, you know, you look at the fastest laps. Most of the drivers set in the top five set their fastest laps on lap 57. Bottas was half a second or so quicker than Hamilton, who was a little bit hamstrung by his damaged car. But he was still a quarter of a second quicker than Verstappen. So even damaged, he was able to be comfortably quicker. And obviously Verstappen was three quarters of a second behind Bottas. That's quite a margin in the race.
Yeah, no, listen, this is as good a time as any to talk about. I was going to mention Renault, so we should talk about Renault for a bit. But Mercedes, clearly, having won the championship last year, both drivers and constructors, felt that, oh man, that championship was way too tight, and they really redoubled their efforts in a very impressive way. And they look to be, as at least after this first race, as strong compared to the rest of the field as they were in 2013 when they came on with the new V6 hybrid era. It's just been incredible.
Yeah, it's certainly a little ominous. I mean, I think it's too early to tell that the Melbourne track is quite unusual in
this
its
is true.
Characteristics. So there's a possibility that the field will tighten up in the subsequent Grand Prix, but yeah, it doesn't look promising for those people who don't want to see Mercedes finish 1-2 on a regular basis.
Renault, they were talked about as the fourth fastest team, really coming on, becoming a force to be reckoned with, stuff like that. How do you feel like they performed compared to the expectations?
So I think it is a very tight midfield. Okay, you've basically got the top three again. You've got Mercedes, Red Bull, and Ferrari. And then you've got a big group of teams and drivers. And then there's Williams, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But you know, it certainly looks like Haas have a slight edge. But I think it's going to be nip and tuck all year between the middle teams, quite frankly. I think they probably would have hoped for a little bit more out of their first race back other than seventh. I mean, Daniel had a very poor weekend by his standards. I mean, he was out-qualified by Hülkenberg, although it was pretty close. And then he made a silly mistake right at the start, damaging his front wing. and basically putting himself out of the race. So
no, I think mistake is a little hard to call that. I mean, he was, what, you know, 18 inches off the track on grass, and then all of a sudden he hit like a freaking cinder block or something and sabotaged his front wing. To me, that was mostly bad luck.
They are called, you know, they are cars optimized to race on, you know, tarmac surfaces, though. Not off-road, generally. They're not that great off-road. You don't see them rallying too often. Well,
man, ruthless. I was expecting a little bit more sympathy for old Danny Rick, but I guess not. I think that they showed reasonable pace, considering you're right. They qualified extremely close to each other. Hülkenberg ended up ahead with a 22.562, whereas Daniel Ricciardo could only manage a 22.570, 8/1000 slower. So yeah, they were very close to each other. Hülkenberg is more comfortable with the car. Daniel Ricciardo is the more highly regarded race car driver. But, you know, Hülkenberg finished 7th. It's a pretty darn strong result for Renault. And, yes, there was a little bit of luck in that race, but, you know, obviously it wasn't just luck. So I think the Renault does have real potential, and I think one important consideration to make is that the Renault is going to be developed throughout the year much better than Haas. That's a weak point for Haas. They're not as fast at developing the car, at least they haven't been in the past. So I think over the course of the season, you're going to see more progress from the Renault team than you will from the Haas team, which will put them ahead.
Haas still haven't fixed their pit stops from last year.
Well, yes, so, that's definitely true.
I mean, I will go back to Hülkenberg. I mean, I do rate Hülkenberg. He has blown away quite a few of his teammates in the last few seasons. He ended Palmer's career. he did a pretty good job against Carlos last year. And I don't think he's going to be a pushover. And I think he sees this as an opportunity. You know, Daniel Ric is considered one of the top F1 drivers, right? He's up there. And Hülkenberg's opportunity is to say, well, look, I'm every bit as good as him, if not better. So that's extra motivation for him, for sure. And I don't think Ricciardo is going to have an easy time, especially as he adapts to a new team, as you suggested, to get one over too quickly on Hülkenberg. He'll fight the whole season. I've no doubt about that.
Yeah, and let's not forget Hülkenberg. I'm pretty sure it was 2011 when he had his rookie season with Williams, and he impressed quite a few folks in that rookie season, and then ended up kind of bouncing around a couple of teams. He was at Force India for a little while, couldn't quite make that break to a full-on team, jumped at Renault when that came a chance because it was a proper factory effort. It's been a little bit slow coming, but, you know. So, yeah, I think the point I'm getting is I think Hülkenberg is going to have a lot of motivation as this. He'll feel like this is his chance just now that's coming on. He kind of gives me a Mark Webber kind of vibe, where Mark had a lot of premise, but he kept flopping around and really wasn't in a properly top team until, whatever, I don't know, 10 years into his career.
Well, that's right, yeah. And then when he did, he came across Mr. Vettel, which was a bit of a problem for him. But, yeah, I mean, I think I think you're right. I think Renault will probably have more development potential over many of the midfield teams. Although I still think, I still see hope for the likes of McLaren, Sauber and one or two other teams, or giving them Alfa Romeo, giving them a good shake. So I think we'll see it mixed, depending on the strengths of the car and the different circuits. I think we'll see that autumn shuffle around quite a bit.
All right. Well, sadly, we kind of have to rush along here a little bit. Family life is cutting in. But Sebastian Vettel finished ahead of Charles Leclerc. That was not because Sebastian Vettel was faster than Charles Leclerc. What did you make of that decision by Ferrari to hold Leclerc back?
It was a very strange decision because they could have pitted both drivers actually and let them have a crack at the fastest lap for the extra point, and yet they chose not to. They could have let Leclerc pit and have a crack at the fastest lap, but they didn't because they had enough gap back to the Haas guy, so or Magnussen at least. So I think that's disappointing. You know, I applaud Mercedes for letting Bottas go and take the win, which is how it should be, right? And to impose team orders race one, when you know you should have just let them have a run at each other, let them sort out on the track, right? And so, yeah, that's not great either. I think, you know, Ferrari were reeling a little bit from their lack of performance. So maybe they just felt they needed to maximize Sebastian's weekend. But, you know, that's why I've always sort of struggled to get excited about Ferrari, because they are so quick to impose team orders. I really detested the whole Schumacher era when they had a dominant car, they still imposed team orders on Barrichello, and it just got old. And I much prefer the teams that just allow their guys to go at it, especially early in the season, right? Later on, you can kind of understand why they sometimes need to resort to it, like Mercedes did last year in Russia. But nobody likes it. But to do it in race one is unacceptable, I think.
Well, yeah, and, you know, what Mercedes did in Russia was debatable, but generally speaking, you're absolutely right, and we are in the situation where, just as you said, first race off, Leclerc showed real promise, had a shot at getting that fastest lap result, and had a shot of maybe being able to, if he was totally uncorked, let around Vettel right away, he might have been able to have something to say to Max Verstappen. I don't know. Maybe it was too much to overcome, but there was a podium, I think, potentially. And to throw that potential result away just shows how Ferrari continually just shoots themselves in the foot over and over again for these just academic, arbitrary reasons that don't actually end up doing them any good. And I'm sorry, I don't think Vettel has earned the place in Ferrari to make those kind of demands. Whereas I have to admit that I think Michael Schumacher had earned that. That doesn't mean it's the greatest thing in the world, but Schumacher was clearly the number one driver there and had the performance to back it up. I don't think Vettel does compared to Charles Leclerc.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, my problem with the team orders back in those days was that, you know, Schumacher pretty much had wrapped the title up by mid-season, and yeah, they were still imposing it. I mean, it just it just didn't make any sense. They had such a dominant car for so many years, and they still kept doing it. And I think it's incumbent on the team, when they have a dominant car, to let their drivers go at it, just like Mercedes did with Rosberg and Hamilton in the classic days of Senna and Prost, right? In the 88 season, when McLaren won 15 out of 16 races, it was still a classic season because it was a great fight between those two drivers. I don't think we would have seen that with Barrichello and Schumacher, but we never even got the opportunity. It was always just, we knew who was going to win as long as the Ferrari didn't have an issue. So, you know, I mean, that's ancient history, but yes, yeah, it's disappointing. It'll be interesting to see if some pressure, if Leclerc starts to really get on top of Vettel. I don't think they can hold that. I think they're going to have to let him go and fight on his own merit, because he may be the lead driver. He may just force their hand.
Yeah, could be. Now, fun little aside to your little tangent off there. Mick Schumacher, Michael Schumacher's son, is supposed to be a part of Friday practice with the Alfa Romeo team at Bahrain. So there will be a Schumacher in an F1 car again this coming weekend.
Yeah, that's cool. Be good to see how he goes.
But we have to move on for now. And I have to once again tell you how great IndyCar is this season. It's only getting better.
I'm sorry, I've got to just interject. We've got to talk for 15 seconds about Kubica, because that was an awful performance.
Yep, go. 15 seconds, go.
I mean, this guy, he disaster in quali, right? He was slow in testing compared to Russell. Awful in quali, hit the wall twice, and then made a mess of the race. I mean, we were hoping he was going to come back and steady the ship at Williams. If he keeps going like that, I'm afraid he's got to be dropped. That was a horror weekend.
Yeah, that's true. And he finished three laps down when everyone, Russell was two laps down, which is sad to say on its own. But yeah, he was. It was not great, and it was not the Kubica that we knew. He qualified 20th with a 126.067, compared to George Rush, who qualified 19th with a 124.3. So there's almost 2 seconds between them. That was bad. I agree.
I mean, we're all excited to see him back, and good on him for making the recovery. But we all expected a lot more than that. So let's hope it was a one-off and he's back to his usual self from now on.
IndyCar. IndyCar is great. IndyCar is so wonderful. They've had two great races already.
I've watched them.
They've had two different winners. And most recently, they were at Circuit of the Americas. They did not lap the track as fast as Formula One did, but I think they put on a much better show.
Ooh, I think that's debatable. I quite enjoyed the race, mainly because of the yellow car period, because otherwise it had been dominated by Power and Rossi, right? I mean, they ran away with it. And maybe Herta was in the mix.
Yeah, Colton Herta was there all along. And I can imagine, it was so hilarious. Colton, after he got out of the race, he said, "Yeah, man, I'm exhausted. I need a nap." I'm like, "Oh, come on, man. You're almost 19. You're not almost 3. Like, you don't need a nap, man."
But yeah. I think, you know, Power was robbed, wasn't he? I mean, he was in control of that race from start to finish. Rossi was having a good go. I'll give him a lot of credit. But I never think he was going to quite get on terms with Power. And then the pace car came out just the wrong time for both of them. Power never – that ended his race because he had a clutch problem or something.
Yeah.
And then Rossi got pushed down the order because he pitted out of sync. So you know, handed the race to Herta. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was okay. I mean, there wasn't a lot of real passing. I mean, the thing that shocked me most was the fact that they weren't enforcing the track limits.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it.
You loved it. Well, that's what caused the accident, because they were all off the racing line, off the racetrack, actually, onto the runoff area, you know, three cars wide, all trying to come back onto the line. And that's what led to the accident. I don't think that's a good move.
That was one accident. That was one accident on lap 45. Formula One at COTA, you know, they have local yellows, so the full course caution, not necessarily, but there's multiple times they bump into each other all the time. It's the exact same thing, just at different points in the track. I entirely disagree with you.
Okay. I mean, it was interesting to watch that, you know, the lines that they took, given that they could use, you know, all of the available hard surfaces, you know, and it was... I mean, the cars look decent. I was shocked how much slower they are than F1 cars. But, you know, I mean, it is a standard formula.
Yeah, it's effectively a spec series, and their horsepower numbers are on the low side. And I do believe I still have to wait. I'm going to get impatient, I'm sure. But it's going to be the 2021 season that the engines are going to get a rules change of their own of sorts. And they're going to be pushing better than 900 horsepower. And that's going to put IndyCar more to the level where they deserve to be. And I want to give Colton more credit here, because he was top three the entire time. He was staying with Rossi pretty darn well. And those three, Power, Rossi, and Herta, were ahead of everyone else comfortably. And then when after the yellow flag finished, the whole field was bunched up. The person that was right behind Colton Herta was Joseph Newgarden, who is a couple years ago champion, regular race winner, Penske driver. And Joseph Newgarden had, you know, like 120 seconds of push to pass, which is this like 50 or 75 horsepower bump they get for temporary spurts. Newgarden had that. Had much more of that than Colton did. And Colton just ran away with it. I mean, he ended up winning the race with like a 5-second gap or something like that. So Colton was switched on. He drove really, really well and held off championship competition behind him. And I think that deserves a lot of credit.
Oh, it was a classy performance from a rookie. You know, second race in IndyCar. No, I agree. He looked good, looked very good. I was fascinated to hear that his dad... Obviously, Brian Herta, was he ever a champion? He was certainly a race winner in IndyCar, right?
He was definitely a race winner. He was known as the Laguna Seca specialist. He won there twice. And okay. IndyCar's going back to Laguna Seca, by the way. I'm looking forward to that. But
yeah, that's a great track. But what fascinated me was that they sent Colton to Europe to run two seasons of single-seaters on his own. So yeah. They didn't stay with him. I can't imagine sending my kid to Europe, even though I'm from the UK, on their own at 13. That is a brave decision, but it looks like it paid off.
Well, I mean, these days I wouldn't recommend it with Brexit and all. So anyway, there was a fantastic IMSA and World Endurance. Well, fantastic, I'm not so sure, but the IMSA race at the 12 Hours of Sebring, and my good friend and ace photographer Jamie Price was there, and he shot a lot of pictures, and he brought some audio for us. So here it is.
Hey, Robin. Hey, Fun with Cars. It's Jamie Price. I am back from the Super Sebring weekend at Sebring International Raceway. Apparently, Robin is interested in doing more with sports car racing as well as F1 this year. And though I wish that I had more Formula One clients, I'm just not doing that much in the sport anymore. I do a little bit. I'm still planning to be at least two races this year. But most of my clients are in sports car racing now. And the racing is better, the money is better, the cars sound better, and the tracks are better, so I'm not complaining too much. But I had an amazing time this past week at Sebring. For those of you that aren't as big into sports car racing, I highly recommend you get into sports car racing. The only problem with this is that it's a little bit harder to follow just because the races last a little bit longer, but the winning margin from the 12 Hours of Sebring was narrower than it was for the Formula One race in Melbourne, if that tells you anything. So I'm just a big fan of the cars. It's just great racing with lots of manufacturer support. The tracks are so much fun. Sebring doesn't get any better than that. If you're an amateur photographer and just love taking pictures of cars like I do, you know, these IMSA tracks are just so easy to shoot. There's almost no catch fencing. You're right on top of the cars. You're standing basically next to me, separated by, you know, 3 or 4 feet at Sebring. There's really no difference. And sometimes the fans actually get a better perspective than we do just because they can, you know, be up on a scaffolding tower shooting a kind of a cool perspective that I wouldn't normally get. So it's just a really cool thing. But this past weekend they had Super Sebring, which, if you didn't hear about it, is a combined weekend that they had with World Endurance Championship and the IMSA WeatherTech Series. World Endurance Championship had the 1,000 miles of Sebring, which lasted 8 hours. I don't think they actually got the full 1,000 miles in. I think they did 8 hours because they put it on the clock because they had a couple safety cars. But it started at 4 p.m. and ended at midnight on Saturday morning. And then the IMSA WeatherTech 12-hour race started at 10:40 a.m. on Saturday and ended at 10:40 p.m. on Saturday night. It was just an amazing weekend of great racing. I'm very fortunate that I had some great clients that I've had for a long time. I was able to work with the Toyota LMP1 hybrid team, Toyota Gazoo Racing, the Le Mans LMP1 team. It's just incredible to work around those cars. The drivers are the best in the world. You know, it's always kind of special to work around Fernando Alonso and Mike Conway and Kamui Kobayashi and Kazuki Nakajima and Jose Maria Lopez, and just these guys are just Sebastian Buemi's, you know, these are all basically ex-F1 drivers that are still at the top of their game, just, you know, best sports car drivers in the whole world, really. And the car is just incredible. It's an amazing piece of technology. It's a shame that Audi and Porsche aren't still around to compete at the top level, but you can blame the ACO and the FIA for that. That's no fault of Toyota's, and you know, a lot of people are kind of, they like to shit on Toyota and you know, just give them a hard time about, you know, well, you're not competing against anybody. It's not that hard to win. It's not that hard to win Le Mans. It's not that hard to win races. It doesn't matter what race it is. You still have to beat the race. And, you know, actually the racing between the two cars is incredible. You have amazing races that are separated really not by very much time at the end of the day between the two cars, and there's no team orders between the two cars. You know, best car wins is the mentality that Toyota has. So, you know, each car has a different strategy. It's up to the drivers and the engineers for that car to decide what their strategy is. And the only rule is don't hit the other car. So you get some great racing. You know, if you're an F1 fan, then you've put up with enough years of it basically being Sebastian Vettel against Mark Webber, or Sebastian Vettel against himself, or Lewis Hamilton against himself, or, you know, Lewis Hamilton against Nico Rosberg for a couple of years. I mean, there's really not a lot of difference if nobody else is there to compete or able to compete. There's not a lot of difference between what's going on in sports car racing. And it's just sad that the financial side of things has just made it too expensive to compete at that level. But it's still an amazing car. It's still great racing across the board in sports cars, from the GTE AM and Pros, the GTD cars and IMSA, the GTLM cars and IMSA. You know, they look great, they sound great, the racing is great. You know, you get 12 hours of action-packed racing, and it doesn't get any better than that. And to have two of those world-class races on one weekend at Sebring was really special, to have all those fans running around. And, you know, I've never been to the Nürburgring Nordschleife. I'm going this year for the first time to the 24-hour race. But everything that I've ever heard and from my own experience, Sebring is the best race in the world for fan atmosphere. It's right there with Le Mans, maybe even a little bit better. Just the fan access is better. You're closer to the cars. There's less catch fencing. With all of the restrictions on safety and everything, especially in Europe, it's still kind of hard for fans to feel like they're close to the action. And we're very fortunate here in America that you don't have that, you know, liability sense, I guess. But I'm very fortunate that I get to work at these amazing tracks that are just a lot of fun to be at, and they're beautiful and filled with trees and grass and kind of a very far cry from what you'd get in Formula One these days, where they're mostly big parking lots. But anyway, that's kind of my Sebring wrap up. I'm really looking forward to the next race. I won't be going to Long Beach. The next race that I'm doing is the Mid-Ohio Grand Prix in Danville, Ohio. And then after that, I have my first time to the Indianapolis 500. I'll be working for at least one driver. We'll see if I pick up anybody else, but I've got a pretty good client, and I'm really excited to work with this team and cover the race for the first time. So it'll be really exciting to be there and just experience this bucket list race that I've never been to, and very much looking forward to photographing it. But hope to hear from you all soon. Give me a follow, Jamie Price Photo on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you know, most of the other social media handles. That's where you can find me. If you ever have any photography questions, give me a shout. I'm always happy to answer anything, and I hope you guys enjoy the racing. Bye.
Thank you, as always, Jamie, and I have to say I'm super excited to hear that you're going to be a part of the Indianapolis 500. Always an epic race, always great to see, and always super important visually. So, but anyway, I want to let you guys know that there is just a few days before the second round of the Formula One Championship at the Bahrain Grand Prix. That's coming this Sunday, March 31st. The next IndyCar race is in Alabama. That's April 7th. The next World Endurance Championship race is in Spa. It's the 6 hours of Spa, and that is not until May 2nd. And the IMSA series, the American Sports Cars, they're going to race at Long Beach April 13th. And I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, we did it.
Just about. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Chris. It was fun talking to you as always. I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.